steam train. Jump on the steam train. We real estate disruptors.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us for today's episode of Real Estate Disruptors. Today, we have my great friend, Eric Brewer, with The Brewer Method, and he flew in from York, Pennsylvania. Talk about going from startup to succession, which, you know, doing 3,000-plus transactions, 400-plus a year. Have a little knowledge about all that. If this is your first time tuning in, I'm Steve Trank, sales trainer, and every month, we help hundreds of people buy more houses at deeper margins. If you want to join us on our training calls, DM me the word sales on Instagram. And I am on a mission to create 100 millionaires. And the information on this podcast alone is enough to help you become a millionaire in the next 5 to 7 years. If you'll take consistent action, you will become one. And the show is brought to you by our sister company, InvestorLift. Get access to over 2 million cash buyers across the country. Go to InvestorLift.com. Put in disruptors to get 10% off. And if you get value today, please tag a friend below. Share this episode right now. That way we can all grow together. And don't forget, we do have Parting the Disruption tomorrow, which is always a little bit of fun, a little bit of chaos. And this is a live show, so ask your questions for Eric to answer. You ready?
Yeah, man, I'm ready.
All right, so it's been a year and a half, almost 2 years.
Yeah.
Since you were last out.
Yes.
Things have changed a little bit since we last met.
A little bit, yeah. A lot of external change, a little bit of internal change, but yeah, things have shaken up a little bit.
Yeah, so can you walk us through what has been some of the biggest changes you've experienced in the last year and a half?
So I think a year and a half ago, I was just onboarding my current COO. And trying to think about, like, the last time I was here versus now, there was a certain anxiousness about me back then, right? I think a lot of it had to do with, if you think about the timing of October, right? To your point, it was the towards the end of the toilet paper crisis, or what's known as COVID.
Yep.
And I had recently just transitioned out of my current COO, which in my organization, that person runs the company,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I was relatively hands-off for the most part.
The company and, or the companies?
The company at that point, for us, we had one or two entities outside of our core business, but effectively 90% of our resources were allocated towards our home buying business. And that was hard, right? Like, hard because I felt like I had failed. Mm-hmm. I either hired the wrong person or had the right person and didn't manage and lead them effectively to keep them around. So I was just really struggling with trying to identify what happened. And was super excited about my new COO, but it was so new and so fresh.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's easy to think back and say, well, when I hired the last guy, I was excited about him too. And that ended, you know, not ideally. We parted amicably, but, you know, it was disruptive.
Yeah.
So back then there was this anxiousness, there was this tension about me. Cause I watched the video last week just to prepare to be here. And, I was like, man, I'm in a different place right now. I'm just I'm more relaxed. I feel like I have a little bit more clarity about where I am and where I'm headed. I'm healthier. I feel better. I think I look better, but I'll leave that up to you.
Subtly. So, you know, I think that there is that fear, right? You're talking about, you got the COO, didn't work out the way you were hoping, you get this new one, and you're like, you know, how much is it you? How much was it process, environment, whatever?
Yeah.
So obviously, Benmont is still with you, and man, he's an incredibly valuable asset.
Yeah.
So what do you think some of the things that you've done to grow yourself? Because I think if it doesn't work out, oftentimes we got to look at, like, you know, maybe you weren't the right leader for the previous COO. So what have you done to make sure you're a better leader today?
It's a great question. And I think where I ended up was I gave full responsibility for why that relationship ended to that person. Because at that time, he effectively made the decision that he didn't want to grow into what I needed the COO to be. Cause we went through this phase where, I talk a lot about level five leaders, right? There's a level one, which is you're a skilled person. Level two is you're a member of a team,
mm-hmm.
right? You're able to do your job at a skilled level. Plus you can actually work alongside other people.
You can work with other human beings.
It's from Jim Collins, by the way. Level three is you become a competent manager. And he was like that competent manager, and I needed him to move to like that executive leader. And then level five leadership is where you talk about the paradoxical combination of this undying belief that we can accomplish everything, but the ability to stare brutal facts and the truth in the face, right? It's tough to be able to do. Jim actually says that charismatic leaders oftentimes fail more often than folks that are a little bit more of a realist. Kind of a crazy combination, right?
Yeah.
So you got to try and buffer your charisma. And I think I was crystal clear about what happened, but took full responsibility for the fact that the 2.5 years that he worked for me, I failed to lead and develop him to the person that was prepared to move to that next level of leadership. So that was helpful for me to just have that clarity. And it really made it, I think, I wouldn't say easier for me, but it made the hiring process of Benmont that much easier.
Yeah.
Because I knew where I was at that particular phase in my leadership journey. I knew I needed someone that would be willing to sort of deal with my issues, we'll say.
Yeah.
But also would be willing to grow with me. And he's proven to be, he's become basically my best friend, which is something I talk a lot about.
Yeah.
With people that I think when we think about who our number two would be, I'm a firm believer that you don't have to start off as best friends, but you really should have a relationship with that person where they are part of your top 3 to 5 people in your circle.
Yeah. I love what you're saying there because, I myself was having a hard time letting go of my own business, which is crazy, right? Because I don't like to do a lot of things, but I was still having a hard time letting go.
Yeah.
And what I did was I brought in, Larry Ash and Annie was still the team leaders. And like, I was like, all right, if I bring them in, they can help everyone else grow, then I can finally let go. And what we learned was how bad of a leader I was.
Yeah.
All right. And it forced me to elevate my leadership. And it was really cool was, to get messages from my team yesterday, we're really excited to see how much you've grown and allowed us, right, to rise up with it. So
it's the hardest thing I've ever done in my life.
Yeah.
The hardest thing I've ever done in my life. And we'll talk a little bit, I'm sure, about, some of the consulting and leadership and coaching that I've done now. And it's been the most difficult thing because it requires you to virtually abandon all of the behaviors that got you to the place to where you deserve to hire someone in order to earn the right to retain that talent. You need to be the opposite of the person that you were when you created the opportunity. I said this by accident. I was out working with a friend of ours, Marcus Krigler, who's in CG.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going through this part, and I was helping him through his quarterly, and he had this group of tasks. And I don't think Marcus will, it's nothing bad. But he's like, no, I'll take that. I'll take that. And I'll take that. I was like, hey, man, we got a list of 73 things here for you to get done this quarter. Do you think maybe we've put you in a bad spot? And he goes, I just want to save them the hassle of having to do the work. And I said, you're not saving them from the work. You're cheating them from the opportunity.
Yeah.
And he was like writing it down. And then he said it to me later. He's like, dude, that thing that you said to me was just eye opening. And that's what happens is that we have such a sometimes obsessive behavior over being in control when we build a business or we start this entrepreneurial journey. And then the instant you hire your first person, you need to start to unwind that.
Right.
And it's hard because you're like, well, that's not what got me here.
That what got you there is also not what you observe from other people as well.
Yeah.
Right. Like we didn't necessarily grow up and learn our business.
Dude, I grew up in the car business in the 90s.
Yeah.
Right. I had phones thrown at me. I got MF'd literally every day. And I was a good salesperson.
Right.
So think about how they treated the guys like you that didn't sell a lot. I'm just kidding.
Model.
It was how we were raised a little bit differently. It's how we grew up in business. But things are certainly different. And I don't think people have changed. Everybody talks about millennials this and millennial that. I think just today people are less likely to be treated like I was crap.
You're right. They're less tolerant of it.
Yeah. I almost dropped the S word there. I wasn't sure about the profanity policy, but.
But, going back to your point, though, you're talking about all the different levels, right? Like, for me, we were going over this as a team yesterday. Like, I think as an individual contributor, I believe I was excellent,
mm-hmm.
right? As a follower, I think I was pretty good.
Yeah.
And then once I got to management, I was like, this there's some holes we need to fix before we move up.
Yeah.
So we're talking about the show is from startup to succession.
Yeah.
So before we jump into the path, can you explain what succession means? Because our general audience is still working on their first 10 to 50 deals.
So I think succession can really take on one of a couple different things, right? Like I think about succession in my business two potential ways. I have almost a half dozen kids, right? I have five. I'm probably working on, not probably, I'll have a sixth child by the next time you invite me back.
Too much time. Got it.
And so succession for me may mean creating a legacy of a business that has a big enough purpose and a big enough impact that my children would want to work at a business that I've built. Mm-hmm. Not have to, not be forced to, not have that be their best option. Like I literally think about my 18-year-old son, and he'll probably go to college and be out in the workforce in 4 years. Like there's no bigger compliment for me to be able to accomplish two things. One, create a business that is his dream job.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like,
yeah, that's
think
huge.
About that for a second, because I think it says two things. One, they want to be part of what's going on, right? It's like, I mean, they got great culture over there. Those people are incentivized. They celebrate success. There's accountability. Like they create these paths for you to constantly level up. And then I think it also says something about what he's observed about me being part of that business and running that business for 20 plus years is that, hey, like I kind of like how my dad turned out.
Mm-hmm.
And if that was part of his journey, I wouldn't mind following in his footsteps. So succession for me could mean creating a business that my kids could participate in and would want to participate in, and give me the ability to step away and still have Benmont run it.
Yeah.
They would have to start at the entry-level position. My son works there in the summer, and he's a gopher. He runs for construction materials, right? So he would have to apply for a position there, qualify, and win the position no different than anybody else.
Yep.
I think he's a smart enough kid and a hard enough worker, we'd find a place for him. And then the second succession would be, and we talk about this a lot, and the one thing I wish I could go back and do differently is now I have the luxury sometimes of sitting with some people that have built some extraordinary businesses, sometimes outside of real estate, whether it's a chain of coffee shops. There's a young man with me here today that him and his wife own a chain of boutique coffee shops throughout the Phoenix area, right? It's pretty cool. I've met some people that are in venture capitalists, that they're private equity, and they start a business with succession in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like they actually won't go into the business unless they have a clear path to get to an exit. So if I were to go back and do this all over again, I would have started my business with the exit in mind. And the only thing that would have changed is I would have progressed as a leader. I would have put more emphasis and focus on systems and processes and removed myself from the business sooner than I feel like I've been able to without that in mind.
You know, something I've heard quite a bit is that wholesaling is a young man's game.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is just to wholesale, generate enough active income so you can buy enough rental properties so you can live off the passive income.
It's a great path, yeah.
Right? But you're saying put a little bit more thought into it, mm-hmm. you know, create an ideal outcome for you and your business.
Yeah, so I've been paying attention. I think one of the things that'll be next for me, you actually introduced me. There's a gentleman that teaches you how to flip businesses.
Mm-hmm.
I saw on the page the other day, because I went through the course, there was a guy that 2 years ago bought a power washing business. Some might say that that's a young man's business too.
Yeah.
Right? You're on TikTok. I'm a consumer. You're a content provider. I watch it. And I'm fascinated when a guy like runs the wand across the sidewalk, right? And all the little dirt disappears and it's in a straight line. And I'm watching, and it's mostly kids that spend $5,000 on a trailer and some startup equipment. Then they show you like what they make,
mm-hmm.
right? As a power washer, a one man business. So I saw this power washing business that exited at $4
million. Wow.
They sold a power washing business for $4 million.
Yeah.
Because that guy went into that business and he bought it at he bought it for $300,000, which was 1 year's worth of income. So he bought it from that owner because it had $300,000 worth of net money, which by any measure, a $300,000 net business is a great business. It would probably put you in the top 1%.
Yeah.
But it was only worth $300,000 because that person was the business. Mm-hmm. He didn't have systems. He didn't have processes. He didn't have a leadership team. He didn't have a marketing strategy. He didn't have a core customer. So this guy came in and put systems and processes in, hired people, got it up to, say, $1 million worth of net profit. So he 3X'd the profit. But now someone said, I'd like to own that business. And I right. could buy it and never show up at the office mm-hmm. and get a check for $1 million a year.
Yeah.
So he went into that with an exit in mind. And I think you can do that in wholesale. I think you could structure the business in a way to where it is sellable, because what's really different from wholesale than power wash or a coffee shop or anything else? It's just historically, I think, because of the lucrative nature of the wholesale business,
yeah.
you could operate and be profitable in spite of yourself, right? Like you literally—
yeah, the margins are so large.
Yes. You can do one deal a month and cold call. Like if you sit and you cold call 4 hours a day and do one deal a month, you can net $25,000 a month and make $300,000.
Yeah.
Like that's not bad.
No, that's right? great.
So what happens is the market and the business has been so forgiving for so long, no one ever had to set it up like a real business. You could operate it for as long as you decided you wanted to and make a lot of money. And in our circle, people have always said these businesses are not sellable. And about 3 years ago, I accepted that as a challenge. It was, I think it's sellable. We've just never run them in a manner that's permitted yeah. us to sell them. It's we've never made it to where anybody would want to go. And we're always stressed out. And it's like, I couldn't wait to buy that business, right? It's like, I'm going to buy that wholesale business. That dude is always stressed out and worrying about where his next check's going to come from. And some months he makes 200 grand, another month he makes eight.
Or loses money.
Right. Yeah. So I think if you start with the end in mind, the wholesale business can be something you can exit from in a reasonable amount of time.
So let's talk about what are some of the major milestones between startup to succession.
So I would say for me, and I know it might seem premature, but it is 100% the right people. And when you look at our business, right, it's effectively a sales organization. Mm. And so when you look at the positions, we talked about this on Pardon the Disruption, right? Like we talked about, I think, 2 weeks ago, is what would be your first hire? Mm-hmm. There was two or three different opinions, but what we cannot dispute is that hiring the right people, regardless of if your first hire is an EA or a VA or an IPA, whatever the heck it is, right? Like, make sure you define what the right person looks like. And for me, that's typically they have to be a great example of our core values. They got to be an ideal team player. Mm-hmm. It's a good book. It's they got to be humble, hungry, and smart. And smart refers to EQ, not necessarily IQ. We look at predictive index and DISC and make sure that person matches up with the right behavioral profile to fit in that position. And that they have a good cognitive ability. In real estate, you got to be a quick learner no matter yeah. the position. And if you're committed to doing that, and I posted this the other day and got a lot of good feedback. It was an excerpt from one of Jim Collins' books that I'm reading. And he said, you can't motivate the wrong people.
Right.
Right. But what you can do is hire the right people and manage them in a way that they never become unmotivated.
Mm, that's powerful.
Because that's a lot of times what happens.
Yeah.
Possibly what happened with one of the three COOs that I let down over the course of a 7-year time frame is I might have hired the wrong person and then either not given them enough leadership or gave them too much management, mm-hmm. right? Where I didn't give them enough freedom. And I might have unmotivated that person.
Yeah, it's something that I learned, again, recently from Larry Yatch, just talking about, like, there's control-centric, where I got to be in your business, right? And then there's empowerment-centric, where just like, all right, Eric, do whatever. And what happens often is that we're either too control-centric
yeah.
or we're too hands-off. And we got to find that right balance depending yeah. on the team member.
It's funny, right? It's always that balance. Like, we was talking about, like, the paradox of having visionary confidence that you can accomplish anything that you set your mind to, mm-hmm. but the willingness to stare the brutal facts in the face right. and allow people to give you the truth. And by the way, like, shout out to Larry and Annie Yatch, right? Like, when you talk about, for those of you who don't know those people, like, when you talk about leadership and execution, like, my man operated as a SEAL team leader, Mm-hmm. Right. So when you talk about the high stakes of operating a mission,
failure
it's life or death.
Failure was very expensive.
Yeah. So it's pretty, it's amazing. I've done some training with them. I'm actively trying to figure out the timing of them coming in and working with our team and working with me one-on-one to help us, because he's got that whole new facet of the thing. Is it used to just be leadership. Now he has that whole business aspect.
Yeah.
Where he ties in what he's learned about leadership into business. So for anybody that's looking for leadership training, I would strongly encourage you to reach out to Larry and Annie Yatch.
So one thing you talked about is make sure you hire correctly, right? We've all heard hire slow and fire fast. We've all heard it.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of us that are solo operators or run really small organizations say, I don't have time to hire the right way. Like, I just need somebody now. I need to grow now, or I need to scale now.
Yeah.
What are you telling them?
I mean, I think it's almost obvious. Like, if you just ask that question and step away, they'll figure it out on their own.
Right.
The reason you don't have time to hire the right person is because you've hired the wrong person probably just prior to this, right? I just read a book. I can't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but it's a CEO who only does three things. He talks about people, culture, and numbers.
Trey Taylor.
Yeah, Trey Taylor. Great book, yep. Right? People, culture, numbers. Like, as a CEO or a business owner, even if you're the most important thing you can do is take time to hire the right person. So here's the other caveat that I would say to that, though. I think a lot of people give that advice, but they'll omit the fact that there's an urgent aspect of it. If you're constantly recruiting, you'll never be in a position to where you have to hire someone out of an urgent demand and not have the time to get the right person. So one of the things that you and I, we spoke at CG and talked about this, right? Because of our activity on social media, I put up a post the other day just to show you the stark difference between someone that is active on social media and someone is not. I'm mildly active on social media, right? Put out one or two videos a day. I try and teach whatever I feel like I'm qualified to teach.
That's pretty active.
It's mildly compared to you, right? And I put up a video Wednesday of last week that we were hiring for two sales positions.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, and one of the things that here's a small piece of advice I've learned that has worked well for me. When I look at job descriptions, that's 95% saying, this is what you have to contribute to the company. You need to be able to do this. You got to be able to do this. This is how you should behave. This is, and it's like,
boring.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Why don't you tell me what it's like to work there?
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to flip the script. Let me tell you 90% of this job posting, what it's like to work here. Here's our training.
Mm-hmm.
We offer something, Ben Mott's idea. We launched two great ideas he had that only two though. He's only had two great ideas. Everything else was mine. But there was two that we implemented this year that we've seen a phenomenal response to. One was, if we're at 100% or higher of current monthly revenue goal, everybody's off Friday at 1 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
It's the response has been amazing. So I'm in Pennsylvania, right? In the summer, it's the only time you can ever go outside. You guys have summer weather here all year. But in December, like, people are in pain. It's so cold, right? So we try and make the most out of the summer. So if you're off at 12 o'clock on a Friday, you can go to the beach when you might not be able to do that at 5 o'clock. You can go, you know, spend extra time with the family or do something. So we've seen a tremendous response to that. Number two was, we introduced perk days, which is your work anniversary is now a day off.
Mm-hmm.
Your wedding anniversary is a day off.
Yeah, I saw that.
Your birthday. Awesome. Yeah. And it's just, you know, so we've really tried to, that's when you go into talking about when you hire the right people, your primary job is to just make sure they never leave.
Yeah.
So we're constant. We believe we have great people. We want them to stay forever. So we act as if we're constantly trying to recruit them. Bottom line is, social media, when we talk about stuff like that, and I put that job ad out there, I said, here's all of the things that we'll offer you. And there was two sentences about what you need to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like to have some experience in sales, but it's not necessary. It'd be cool if you understood real estate, but if not, we'll teach you.
Yeah.
But you need to align with our core values. Make sure when you send me an email to include your resume and two examples of how you're humble or you're excellent and you're committed to improvement, or you've shown integrity. I got, Steve, 20 overqualified applicants, door-to-door salespeople. It's got to be the hardest thing to do in the world.
Yeah.
And they make a lot of money, right?
Mm-hmm.
I got someone that was actually drafted in the professional lacrosse league, drafted as a professional. I didn't even know that existed. Mm-hmm. Super competitive guy, sold, life insurance policies, which is a cutthroat business. So just got overwhelmed with qualified applicants. Didn't even put an ad out on Indeed or Facebook or anything. Meanwhile, I'm talking to a coaching client who's had an ad out for 3 months for an acquisitions agent in California, mm-hmm. and can't sniff a qualified applicant. Only real difference between our businesses, I'm visible on social media. He doesn't even log in to Facebook.
So if we're looking for humble people, would you and I qualify for this role?
Yeah.
Yeah, you think so?
I don't know, man. I think, I feel like you just kind of came at me there for a second. But I would say that I'm humble. I mean, I am confident, I try and live by the mantra of taking credit for nothing and the blame for everything.
Yeah.
So maybe forced humility, because I've learned it's just the best way to lead people.
Yeah.
But on camera, I'm very humble. After the show, I may make a couple parting comments that might not sound like the most humble guy in the world.
So let's go on to the next step. So step one, hiring the right people. And we kind of dove a little bit into like how to hire them.
Yeah.
What after that routine, because we're talking about like this is like a wide thing, right? Like to go from startup to succession is not like a small venture. This is
so there's a couple creative things that I just had before I came here today. I was working with someone on preparing for their Q4 priorities, and they were talking about a particular candidate. And they mm-hmm. said, "Well, what happens if we bring this person in and they learn everything about the business and they leave, right?" So that's one of the things that I think is a constant sort of back and forth in this business is. We hire people, they come in, they're a maverick, they're a venturer, they learn the business and then they leave. Mm-hmm. So some people have responded to that and gone the exact opposite direction. And they've hired a bunch of less than assertive people and put them in sales positions and then wonder why they struggle because they're so concerned that they'll hire an aggressive, assertive person that'll leave. So two things. One, if someone comes to work for me and they do a good job and 2 years later, we outgrow the relationship. I feel fortunate that I got 2 years worth of good work out of them.
Yeah.
It's not the worst thing in the world, especially if you're constantly recruiting, because you'll have a bench of people that would gladly step up. So in our acquisitions department, we've actually created our lead management inside sales is like the G League for acquisitions. We hire salespeople and lead management, which is where I think a lot of people make mistakes. They try and hire administrative people that can answer the phone but aren't really good at sales. Hire an aspiring acquisitions agent that can learn sales, teach them how to be a lead manager, and in a year and a half, roughly, I've seen the last three acquisitions agents that we've had have come through lead management.
If I was reading correctly, you guys allow your lead managers to be nationwide.
Mm-hmm.
So are your sales, your acquisition managers then?
No, because we're all in person.
So how would
for
that
acquisitions?
Work?
How would what work?
If they're starting as a lead manager in another state, mm-hmm. how would they become an acquisition manager?
They probably so that they would have less of ability to be able to make that transition.
Got it.
Not every person that comes into lead management wants to be in acquisitions.
Right.
I've often said that like the perfect lead manager is someone that can get them all the way up to the appointment, but feels a little uncomfortable when it's time to make them a decision.
Yeah.
So we actually call, so I think we don't call them lead managers. We call them inside sales reps because we want them to think like, be treated like, and behave like a salesperson. We compensate them like salespeople. We train them like salespeople. We hold huddles like salespeople. Lead manager to me is like a person that's organizing like data and placing it in places. And it's like a warehouse manager. An inside sales rep is a salesperson. Their sell is the appointment.
Yeah.
A quality appointment means they've made a sale. Does it make sense? But back to my original point, when you're talking about like the maverick and hiring the people, you can hire a maverick or a venturer person. Let's just call it what it is. They're an entrepreneurial mm-hmm. style person, but you need to create an atmosphere inside of your organization that is conducive to an entrepreneur. So as a leader, one of the things that you can do to push those people out of your organization is you hire a maverick or a venturer. Why do we normally do that? Because we don't have a sales process. Mm-hmm. We don't have training. So we need someone that'll just figure it out.
All right.
right? And then we're surprised that after they figure it out, they're risky enough to go out and try it on their own. So if you hire a maverick or a venture, which is a great sales profile, right? Mm-hmm. You have to constantly create a higher ceiling for those people, or they're going to feel like they got to go out and do something on their own.
So two things here. First, I noticed you say maverick venture, but you didn't mention captain.
Yes.
So you don't put captain in that category?
No.
All right. Second question for everyone that's listening. What the heck is a maverick and a venturer?
So I use a predictive index. It's a behavioral assessment. A maverick is a, they break it down into A, B, C, D. If you look at DISC, it's D-I-S-C. A maverick is a very assertive, mostly very social, impatient person that doesn't pay attention to details.
Yeah, it's a straight line, right? D-I-S-C.
Yes. Yeah. When then the captain is, they have some observation and some desire to mm-hmm. be more precise. I definitely see a distinct difference between a venturer and a maverick and a captain. Mm-hmm. Captains are much more stable people.
Yeah.
But that's
more normal mavericks.
Yes. Yes.
An adventurer is what?
Pretty much the same as a maverick, just a slightly skewed. I don't know which one it is between A, B, and C, but I feel like a venturer's probably. That might actually be a more exaggerated version of a maverick. I'd have to look at the difference between the two. They're very similar, very entrepreneurial spirited people that are super assertive. I would put maverick and venture almost identical. Captain, much different. They're much more organized.
So I think when we got into this, we were talking about like you have people that have had mavericks and venturers and got burned.
Yeah.
And the lesson they took from it was
not to hire them.
Not to hire those. Not to grow the process, not to have build an environment that supports them, but to just stop hiring them.
Yes. And then they go and hire the opposite. It's like a rebound after a bad breakup with your girlfriend, right?
Yeah.
So they go and then hire the opposite of a maverick or a venturer or those particular profiles, and they end up with sometimes untrained, undisciplined, unassertive salespeople, which is doomed for failure.
Right.
So if you hire those people, they can succeed. We've had a lot of success with some of the more promoter type profiles, which are way less assertive, or someone's who is more of a strategist that's very disciplined when it comes to process, but then we hold them accountable to the sales process. Mm-hmm. So they don't have the instincts to close a sale, but they have the discipline to a process that says now's the time to ask for the sale.
Yeah.
So any real profile can fit. It's just a matter of what atmosphere, what culture, what type of process, what type of accountability do you have? But generally in a wholesale company, we hire mavericks and ventures because we have no process, we have no accountability, and they're likely to figure it out.
Yeah.
But once you have systems and processes and accountability and coaching in place, you can hire a milder version of that maverick or continue to hire that person and just know that you're going to constantly have to create a higher ceiling for that person, or they're going to feel like they've outgrown the opportunities that you provide, and they're going to go out on their own.
So we talked about, you know, the people component. What else is involved in trying to build a company with succession in mind?
You know, it's something that for me was always this elusive, like, purpose and core values and things of that sort. And I've spent like the last 2 years really diving into leadership, and because of how big of an impact my lack of leadership, you know, had on my life and my business, each time that I made that transition, I've been through 3 executive level COO integrator style people until I got to my 4th, and now feel like I had a better understanding of the expectations of the position, and I was able to improve as a leader to properly support that person. And I would say that probably the biggest difference for me along those lines. Repeat the question for me again so I make sure I answer specifically.
About, you know, like the next step after people.
So purpose, right? So as I've dug into that, I've learned just how important it is. And it's not something when we start the business, we go, who's like, what market are you in? Mm-hmm. What's your number one lead strategy?
Right.
Right. And are you virtual in person? Mm-hmm. No one says, hey, what's your company purpose? But it's literally what people care about almost as much, if not more, than how much they're paid. Like we've seen, you know, I spend a lot of time with Sharper Business Solutions and stuff like that. And part of our Empire curriculum is companies that lead with purpose outperform their peers by 120%.
Yeah.
It's what gets people to work at a place longer for less money when they get that emotional paycheck in addition to the financial paycheck. So some of that stuff is, you know, sort of a brash car guy that grew up in the car business. We didn't talk about touchy-feely stuff like purpose. But we went through the exercise of defining our company's purpose. And then part of what Larry and Annie teach is how you have nested purpose at each one of the departments and how they feed up into the purpose of the company. And then each individual has their own purpose. Like, yeah. Why are you here? When you leave, what would you want people to say about you when you're gone?
Yeah. And I think, you know, just finding and understanding people's purpose, they now feel like they're a part of the mission. So we've talked about hiring and so on. Before I forget, you've got a great video on your company's purpose and everyone's individual's purpose. Mm-hmm. And that is the best reinforcement, right? Yeah. Demonstrating that you believe in purpose. So that's hiring. Now, one of the less fun parts of running a business is letting people go. So can you talk about accountability and what leads to them, you know, self-eliminating from the company?
Yeah, so I read this actually, and I think it was in the COO that only does three things, Taylor. And he actually put it into a unique perspective, and he was talking about, like, you know, people that aren't performing or they're having maybe some personality conflicts with coworkers, and how we struggle sometimes with that. And I've struggled with that as a business owner before, where I hold on to relationships longer than I probably should because mm-hmm. I feel bad. And he actually said in there, and I might not get the words exactly right, but hopefully the point will come across, there's nothing more cruel than to keep somebody in a position to where they feel underappreciated when they're not winning, and then understanding how that has an impact on their life when they leave.
Yeah.
Right. So when it comes to firing, one of the things that we've, I think, done a really good job with people when they're not performing is we always eliminate two things. And this comes from, you know, tons of business studies that you can go out and you can Google it and say 80% of the time when someone's not performing, it's two things. Lack of clear expectations or insufficient training and resources. So the instant that someone's not performing, we go, hey, we just want to restate the expectations. Are they crystal clear? Mm-hmm. And then we give them an opportunity to weigh in before we ask them to buy back in, right? A lot of times we go, these are the expectations. You're crystal clear, aren't you? We're just not asking a question that's going to, like, make it okay for them to give us the truth, right? So that's where you get, I call, compliance versus commitment. And that shows up in results very different.
Yeah.
If someone's walking around this office and they're complying with your vision, that doesn't show up the same way as someone that's committed to it.
Yeah.
So we eliminate clear expectations. And then we also make sure that we've given them proper training and they have access to resources. They might not have the right tech, or they might not have the right piece of equipment or something like that. 80% of the time when someone's not performing, it's one of those two things. So when they're not performing, we restate expectations, make sure that they're committed, and get clarity around the fact that they have all the resources and the training that they need. That's typically a verbal conversation. If they don't make an improvement, we have a written, what we call PIP, or performance improvement plan, where we now document the expectations and say, hey, here's the expectation of improvement over this next 30-day time frame. And if we don't improve in this area by X amount, then the next appropriate action would be this, whatever that is. And then normally by the time you get there, they're going to opt out. If they're not the right person, they're going to say, hey, listen, I'm crystal clear in the expectations. I just don't think I'm cut out for it.
Yeah.
And you've done that person a service. Like, we always feel bad when we terminate a relationship. But, like, if they can't do the job or don't want to do the job, to Trey's point, it is cruel to hold them hostage to that position. You're keeping them from doing something they'd be far better at, that they could probably make more money, that wouldn't impact their personal life and happiness the way that this does.
Might be easier for them to actually do.
Heck yeah.
So two different things here. So you keep mentioning Trey Taylor.
Yeah.
So we're working on getting him on the show. The other thing, you were mentioning compliance versus commitment.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to do this, right? Is that's the... Yeah. We're kind of forcing it on them. So you actually recommended a book that was profoundly impactful for me, which is that Leadership is Language.
Yeah.
Right. So that Navy admiral or captain, where he talks about asking questions that gets buy-in mm-hmm. versus asking suggestive questions that get right. buy-in. And they're two totally different things.
It's like an actual question, not a statement with a question mark at the end.
Right.
Right. They're two different things. And again, I'm reading a really good book right now, Jim Collins, and he talks about Winston Churchill, right? When he was leading his troops, and he had an information department. And their only responsibility was to come and report the brutal facts mm-hmm. of about the reality of their situation. And we don't often set that up or have that present inside of our business. And I've been like that multiple times where I've been like, I don't want to hear the bad news. It's going to mess up my vibe, right? It's just going to kill my positive momentum or my outlook. But you can't fix what you don't know is broken. And Leadership of Language is a really good book, and it's changed a lot. About how I communicate with people because I was getting compliance, not mm-hmm. commitment.
Well, you and I have pretty strong personalities. We're both visionaries. So when we say, this is what we're going to do, like everyone kind of goes on. And I say, it's like, hey, like you're in, right? Like, yes.
Like, it's not even really a question, right? It's just, it's a statement. And you're almost like not like if you ever watch, like you're in, right? And you're like, what are they supposed to say? Like, you're the boss.
Right.
Right. So, and if you don't create a culture where people will push back and go, no, I'm actually not in, I don't understand it, or I don't think that's the right thing to do by the customer. If you don't create that culture, you either have to fix your language to make it easier for people to confront you and make suggestions about what's best for the customer or best for the team. Or best for the desired outcome, or really change your language so that it's more likely that people will make suggestions, even if it doesn't align with what you're thinking.
So for everyone that's listening, right, debating whether they get the book or not. Like for me, I've always encouraged input. I've always encouraged to challenge me, and I've said that forever, but the words weren't lined up necessarily with how they felt. And the best example I can give for that was, I would say, let me know if I'm missing something, and that's not a safe space. Versus like, what are you seeing that I'm not seeing?
Yeah,
that's a safe space.
Yeah, it's funny. I heard someone say before is that we don't just have to give people their chance to have their say. Mm-hmm. We have to give them the chance to be heard.
Yeah.
Right. Because going, hey, you got to give them their say. That's lip service, right? It's like, hey, man, I asked if anybody had any questions. I told you to tell me if I was missing anything. Mm-hmm. Like, what the heck? Mm-hmm. You actually have to give them a chance to be heard. This is what I'm talking about. Like earlier on when I said, leadership is the toughest thing. This is all we're talking about is leadership stuff. And as a visionary, assertive style person, to say to someone, hey, I'm not the smartest person in the world. I mess up all the time. I feel like this is one of the situations where I move really quick and I get everybody excited about a project. And then 3 weeks later, something smacks us in the side of the face and all of you guys saw it coming and I didn't. I feel like this could be one of those situations. Do me a favor. Tell me what I'm missing.
Yeah.
Right? Like that does not feel natural to me. But I've seen the benefit of asking the question that way. And then literally someone will go, I'm glad you said something. I think this is a big mistake. If it turns out this doesn't happen the way that we want it to, this could cripple the whole project. Right? Yeah. Like Larry talks about that. Like we don't fail or we don't plan to fail. Like we go into it and goes, if everything goes perfect, we'll be fine.
Yeah.
Well, how often does everything go perfect? Like literally never. Right? And then everybody's scrambling and trying to figure out what we should do. So if you just have some contingency plans in place, right, and that will normally come from your staff when you give them the permission to disagree with you, you're going to reduce a lot of the fallout and complexity they have. And by the way, how much do they appreciate that when they're able to be heard? And the boss is saying, like, I'll tell them flat out, you're smarter than I am, right? I've just been here longer. That's why my name's on the sign. Right. But I rely on you to tell me what I'm missing. I really need you to look at this from that side of the table and tell me what I'm overlooking or what could possibly go wrong here.
Yeah. The delivery is so important.
Sales.
It's sales.
It's just like we I was talking with a friend of mine earlier about a tough situation that I had with my son. Shout out Camden Brewer. He might be watching right now. He's playing in a men's league basketball game with a bunch of 30-year-olds. He had the game-winning assist last night, and he told me he was going to tune in before he went to his game. But I had a tough situation with him, and I found that I was doing a better job leading the people at the office than I was my people at home. And almost like, you know, turned it off when I got home. It's like, oh, I got to be a really good leader when I'm at the office, but when I get home, they understand. Mm-hmm. They'll tolerate my crappy behavior. And I had an instance where I just wasn't being as good of a father and a leader as I needed to be with him. And I was, you agree, right? That's the right thing to do, right? I was doing that. And I needed to give him more of an opportunity to tell me what was really going on. And turns out, long story short, he's going through his senior year at high school. He's probably a cuspy Division I scholarship athlete, and he's got a tremendous amount of pressure that he puts on himself right now, every single game, every camp, every shot. And I was applying more pressure, and it was not helping him.
Yeah,
He just needed me to be supportive, I guess was the case.
I love that you're bringing home like the leadership part, and you can just turn it off when you get home. Because I used to think, right, like I need to be on at the office, but I can just take it easy at home. And last week, my daughter, right, she's 11 years old, and she gets home, she throws her backpack on the floor, right? Like it's just kind of what you do as a teenager, preteen, whatever.
Or a 46-year-old man, I throw my stuff around too. But
my wife's like, you need to go talk to your daughter and tell her this is not acceptable. I was like, well, I went back to her. I was like, hey, you know, like, do you think that was acceptable? What do you think is the best practice when you get home? And have her create like the best, you know, routine after she gets home. And then at that point, I'm reviewing it, not directing it.
Yeah.
And now it's a lot easier. We originally connected through Collective Genius.
We did.
Right. And it was one of the best decisions I ever made was joining CG. And after I joined, you got moved up into the leadership team. Can you tell me a little bit about that journey?
Yeah, so it's actually one of the milestones in my life that I'm most proud of. And I came into Collective Genius really just looking for a way to generate more seller leads. And that was it. I went looking for, called a friend of a friend, Brad Chandler, who now is a really good friend of mine, a fellow CG member. And I was talking to somebody. I was like, man, you know, I need to figure out a way to buy more homes. The MLS just doesn't cut anymore. You probably remember from our, first conversation when I started in 2006, all the way up to probably, goodness, 2015, I was able to buy 200 homes a year off the MLS and sheriff sale and short sales and, you know, auction sites and all that good stuff. And I started to see that that was becoming harder and harder. The profits were getting compressed. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working twice as hard, making less money. Generally, just not my favorite thing.
Right.
And got introduced to CG. Went to the first meeting. I was like, this is the place for me. They had direct mail providers. They had sales trainers. They had PPC guys. They had Facebook. I was like, dude, this is like a buffet of bucks here. Like, you just walk in and pay your 30 grand a year and you make 300. This is an awesome deal.
Yeah.
I was like one of the guys, right? I was hanging out, always look forward to going to the meetings, would come with like one or two things I needed help with. And I always left with the answer to what I needed and created some pretty cool friendships along the way. But as I was in CG, I was going through, you know, these other sort of seasons of my business where I needed to hire a COO and I needed to become a better leader and I needed to develop my people better. So as I'm developing as a leader, the Eric that showed up at CG looked a little bit different, right? From being one of the guys to being someone that might present on something that was impactful and maybe it more advanced than what other people were experiencing. And it was simply because of the success that I was having with the people that I was able to get to come work for me. And then I was able to create an atmosphere where they didn't want to leave. And it allowed me to be able to speak on that. It's like, hey, I've gone through this. Like one thing people always talk about in our business is like the instant they get to a place to where they have some money, they want to go hire a COO. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's like, first of all, there's a difference between an integrator and a COO. Most people's business need an integrator. The way that I see it is integrator, not so much leadership responsibility, COO, bunch of leadership responsibility. So I would tell you to get crystal clear on which one of those you need. If you plan on still being in the business and being involved in leadership, you can hire an integrator. Mm-hmm. If you want to step away a little bit, right, to go do other projects or maybe just to disconnect from the business, you need a COO. They cost two different prices, mm-hmm. and they're two different people, right? But what happened was is I was able to talk about that journey with people and I was becoming a better leader. And CG said, hey, listen, we've kind of watched you evolve from this guy that, you know, came in looking for leads to now people kind of look to you for advice when it comes to sort of all things real estate and leadership and business. And they invited me to be a facilitator, which means we run a room of 30 people that are there to get the most out of a meeting. It's a huge responsibility. And turns out I love it. I think I'm pretty good at it. It's given me the opportunity to speak on that main stage, which you've been arm in arm with me, you know, and we delivered probably what I would say one of the top 10 like non-keynote presentations in the last 5 years that I've been around, where we encouraged what 200 people to get out their cell phones and get active on social media. And that meeting, people were coming up to us like, dude, I just bought a 16 unit apartment building off that Facebook post.
It's crazy.
Rob Neilinger now, right? That guy was like not on social media. We talked about him as a case study. And he's all over TikTok. He's up to like 12,000 followers. He's really good at it.
He is.
And when we first talked to him, he said, oh, dude, I don't really like to do it now. You know, he's all over my For You page.
Yeah.
So it has been life-changing for me. Being part of the group and then being asked to be part of the leadership team has introduced me to a mentor-style relationship with people in this real estate community. And turns out it's probably the thing that I was put here to do. I think positively impacting people by developing meaningful relationships and then leveraging my experience to help them through whatever phase of life or business that they're going through. Because business can be hard, man. And it can break you down if you let it. And I've been through there. I mean, I've been through sleepless nights where I was worried about my business and how was I going to manage it? And if I'm going to hire somebody and can I afford it? And are we going to make payroll? And that's tough.
I think there's a lot of people going through that right now as
dude,
well.
Dude, it's, and you know what? And we haven't created an atmosphere to where it's okay for people to talk about that. Mm-hmm. Like it's a bunch of entrepreneur, super assertive people. Outside of CG, I've never seen a place, but I was at the last Collective Genius, which, I mean, you got to figure this is what, back in June? Mm-hmm. It's literally when, like, stuff was popping off.
Yeah.
Rates were skyrocketing, fuel prices are through the roof, right? We're, like, smack dab in the middle of Build Back Better, right? So everybody's there with their eyes wide open. Like, what is going to happen? There was so much attention at that meeting. Everybody was on the edge of their seat, and there was one of the owners of a major operation in there that I had a conversation with shortly after lunch about trying to navigate through this. And you know, they were seeing their business change in real time. And at the end of the meeting, I turned around. And he came up to me. And he dropped his book bag and he hugged me. 6'3", 6'4", 50-year-old man, and he just sobbed. And I was like, whoa, like, what? Like, what's going on? And he just, after he hugged me, he's like, man, just thank you so much. Like, I was just so, you know, distraught about what I was going to do, and I just feel better. Like, everything's going to be okay. Yeah. And he's like, will you talk to me once a week or so between now and whenever I feel better? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, so for me, that was the thing. Like at the end of that meeting, it was probably the most anxious I've ever been to show up to a CG event, 'cause I knew how much it meant to people. The market was changing in real time. It felt like 2008. It felt like COVID when it first hit and nobody knew what was going to happen. And for a business owner, I mean, I remember when they shut my business down in Pennsylvania, I was scared to death.
Yeah.
Like literally you weren't allowed to go to work.
Right.
Right. Unless you had a waiver.
Pennsylvania.
Right. Let's don't get me started on that. This will get deleted if we talk too much about that, right?
So, like, one of and by the way, you and I, we had an opportunity to speak on stage together, and man, that experience working with you, working with Ben Mon, right, gave me a whole new level of appreciation. What goes into making a main stage?
60 hours. We measured it's about 60 hours for per person.
Yeah.
Right? So 60 man hours to prepare for one of those presentations. We spent a ton of time on that.
Yeah. But it was awesome. So since then as well, since you were last on here, you sold your brokerage. So I shut down my brokerage. Yeah. Last week was officially the end of Stunning Homes Realty, right? We all moved our license over the reel. So you also, and not too long ago, also shut down your brokerage.
Yeah. So shut down my involvement.
Shut down your involvement. I apologize. Yeah.
So I was an active owner. I was an active participant. And I just frankly, the real estate agent business is tough. It's very transactional. I think a lot of real estate brokerages and companies struggle to build a culture that's rooted in purpose that people actually buy into. And more so in the real estate agent side of the business, I've seen, like, I call them split hoppers. Like, they're constantly hopping from one brokerage to another because of the split, right? Or the transaction fee. And it's like, man, if we're literally going to have conversations about whether or not you're coming to work here because of a $395 transaction fee or the difference between 75% split and 79% split, we just haven't created enough value in this relationship. Like, I don't want to worry about that at all times. And I had some really good partners in that business, all of which we still do a tremendous amount of business with.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to be involved in that. I felt like it was something that was a distraction for me. And I'm probably leaving a tremendous amount of money on the table, but I haven't worried about it. I haven't talked about it. I haven't been part of a meeting in 4 months. And oddly enough, two of their top producers 60 days ago left.
Yeah.
For something very similar. Nothing happened. No big problem. Just like, hey, they came in. They knew nothing about real estate. They now are $7-8 million producers. And the value proposition looks a little bit different than they don't need someone to look over their deals. They don't necessarily need us to provide them leads. So I just feel like particularly in that business that it's just really, really hard, even more so than in our business, to retain talent.
Yeah.
Because they're all entrepreneurs. Like, they're 1099s, right? They just they like to come and go as they please. If you ask real estate agents, I bet the number one answer, if you were on Family Feud and said what the top answer was about why they get into real estate, it was flexibility of schedule.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Which translates to, I might not necessarily want to work a lot.
Yeah.
that was a big deal.
Because you sent me a text message just randomly, right? It's like, hey, what do you think about owning a brokerage? It's like, well, I already own one, but I'm closing it.
Yeah.
Right? And you texted me because someone had reached out to you. Right. And so there's a lot of people in our side as far as the wholesaling side. It's like, you know what? I'm going to open a brokerage and get another stream of revenue.
I think that was a loaded question that I asked you. I wanted you to say, not the best thing in the world.
Right.
So I think it's no different than anything else. I would tell you what I've learned now is if you're going to do it, it needs to be treated as a different business unit, which requires a BUL, a business unit leader.
Mm-hmm.
It needs an integrator level style person to run that business, right? It's not a bolt-on business. It's not like, oh, we'll just send the leads over there and we'll get all this commission. Those people have a different client that they serve. They're paid differently. It looks very similar because it's a house and money, but it's different. So I think it's generally a good way to create ancillary income off of the leads that we create, because we're only going to, convert 10% of the leads that we get on average. So those other 90% certainly could be monetized through those relationships. But generally managing a brokerage at the broker level, not like the Keller Williams model, which we're part of, They call it the mega agent, mm-hmm. right? Where you are the person that drives all the listings.
Yeah, mega agent makes sense.
Correct.
Owning a brokerage, not so much.
It's just, I mean, if you're paying a mega agent 90, like, what's left over?
Yeah.
And then you have all of the liability of the infrastructure, the building, like, all of the liability that comes along with compliance. Like, the mega agent's the spot to be.
Yeah,
I would say so. Not so much the brokerage. But, you know, some people have figured it out and do a great job with it. In my market, our average home sale is only